If there's a Republican president in 2016 and a vacancy occurs in the last year of the first term, you can say, Lindsey Graham said, let's let the next president, whoever it might be, make that nomination. And you could use my words against me and you'd be absolutely right.
Now, I'll tell you this. This may make you feel better, but I really don't care. If an opening comes in the last year of President Trump's term and the primary process is started, we'll wait to the next election. And I've got a pretty good chance of being the judiciary.
You're on the record.
Yeah.
All right.
Hold the tape.
Those were clips of longtime Republican Senator Lindsey Graham from 2016 and 2018, respectively, assuring people that should an incumbent Republican president in 2020 have a Supreme Court vacancy to fill, Graham would, on principle, refuse to consider a vote and give the nominating prerogative instead to the winner of the 2020 election, a promise that, in the wake of Friday's death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Graham promptly and gleefully broke. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Howdy, folks.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Hey, Matt.
So, President Trump this morning on Fox and Friends said that he would announce a nominee for the shortlist of 4 to 5 female candidates for the Supreme Court by this Friday or Saturday, which would give the Senate less than 40 days before Election Day to confirm the pick, the last Supreme Court justice to be confirmed in that short a time was Harry Blackmun back in 1970, which only Nick on this podcast remembers. Of course, the lame duck session of Congress.
We played in minor league ball for the St. Louis Browns organization, man.
That
was good times.
Pre-Orioles. That's the important part.
You know, it was when mitts didn't have that webbing that makes it so easy to catch the ball.
No, it just, you could turn the pivot a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
The lame duck session of Congress could also vote on the pick, of course, theoretically, but there's a complication with that because Arizona Senator Martha McSally, that's not worth laughing at, Nick. She was appointed to
Senator,
the role.
I think you should be making air quotes.
I'll make air quotes on McSally.
Okay.
She was appointed to her role to fill in the late John McCain's seat. And so, therefore, if she loses her election to Democrat Mark Kelly, then she vamooshes immediately and Mark Kelly gets seated as early as November 30th. This all matters because the GOP holds a 53-47 advantage in the Senate, and two GOP senators so far, Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, have indicated that they will not be planning to vote to confirm a justice, at least before Election Day, so we'll see. Anyways, this all obviously affects the nation's jurisprudence, the ongoing bipartisan embrace of will-to-power politics, and so forth, and obviously the election of the presidential election. But first, I want to put all of the small L libertarians on this podcast on the spot. Let's imagine for a hypothetical moment that we are in charge. Catherine Mangue Ward, should the United States Senate hold hearings and vote on President Trump's forthcoming nominee to the Supreme Court?
I mean, yeah, I think they should. I guess I feel like we're actually like now already like 3 or 4 news cycles deep into like the meta politics of this question. And I'm not sure I paused and took a moment to ask the top level question to myself. But yeah, I mean, I basically think the idea that there are norms that apply, that there are constraints on the game, that we should expect non-hypocrisy, that any past Congress has ever really successfully bound any future Congress's behavior is all just vapor. And that we have set up a system where it's, you know, it all comes down to the Supreme Court. And on some level, I don't blame Republicans for saying, we can't miss this opportunity to do a thing we think is genuinely important and secure that spot on the court.
So you're saying that the 2016, or are you saying that the 2016 gambit by Mitch McConnell to not even consider Barack Obama's pick, was that the proper thing to do as well?
I think it is unreasonable to expect Congresses, at least of recent vintage, to do anything different. I think that it's hardball all the way down, and that they were able to do it in 2016, and they might be able to do something different in 2020. And that we should, we should take both sides seriously, that they believe the stakes are very high and that their side is doing something important.
Suderman, take up the question, perhaps with the additional follow-up gloss of, isn't not voting the 2016 choice kind of the, they could have voted no. Really could have held a vote and voted no. But not getting names on the record, isn't that kind of part of the ongoing legislative branch problem of just like not doing stuff?
All of this is part of the ongoing problem of the legislative branch in particular, not doing stuff. The reason that this moment seems so apocalyptic is that the legislative branch has to so
you.
Many people. And I think actually my sense of this is that it may be less apocalyptic than people think. But the reason that so many people are so freaked out about this, and people really are, is that the Congress has for decades just had this slow moving process of declining to do things and letting the executive branch take over a bunch of its lawmaking functions, basically through the regulatory agencies, and then letting all of the big cultural questions, as well as some of the big kind of legal cultural questions about sort of what are the limits of federal power, basically just shuffling all of that off to the courts system and in particular to the Supreme Court. So now, instead of having a bunch of elected dorks deciding things for us as the founders wanted, what we have is a bunch of elected dorks who don't decide things. Instead, they exist only to get elected and to get elected again and again and again. And then whenever anybody asks them to make a tough decision and take responsibility for it, they say, let's just have the executive branch or the courts do that for us. And it's an incredibly terrible and toxic system that leads us to moments like this where everybody fears that apocalypticism, that the apocalypse is upon us. As to the specific question, I guess I think, Catherine's point I take completely. I think there's a lot of merit to it. I guess I don't know what I would do, but what I would say is if your position is that it's hardball all the way down forever, Maybe there's a case to be made that someone who has the power to do so should step in and stop playing hardball and say, hey, guys, let's play responsible ball instead.
No.
Oh, God. Oh.
Yeah.
Softball, Peter.
Volleyball.
Responsible ball.
Matt, I think the really big problem with this whole Supreme Court thing, and actually even the election, is that it's taking our attention away from the way that mailboxes are still being kidnapped and trafficked.
It's terrible.
And I don't know, we need to keep things in perspective. going on what Peter's saying, then it's a great thing that Mitch McConnell, Bitch McConnell, Midnight Mitch in previous Cocaine Mitch, is actually doing the people's work. He's going to hold a vote. There's going to be a Supreme Court nomination coming up. I think, it's nice to see. One of the things I think it's a good thing. I think it's absolutely within both. This is in the realm of, it's obviously legal and procedurally correct. If you want to talk about norms, maybe it's a little bit shaky, but I don't think so. And this is how politics should be played. I think it was shameful that the Republicans, as you were kind of hinting at, Matt, that they didn't hold the confirmation hearing for Garland and vote him down if they wanted to. I think that would have been better. But again, it was also procedurally legitimate. There was no breaking of laws, maybe of some protocols. But, when people start talking about norms being broken, and, Trump is, Vishnu or whatever, Hindu god is the, or Kali, whatever, the Loki of he's bringing Asgardian politics to goddamn, Washington, D.C. Trump, he is part of a process. And when you look at all of the stuff that has gone on that gave rise to him, he's not the instigator of this. He's part of the process. And you have Chuck Schumer, who has been in the Senate for almost as many years as I think he sprung fully formed out of Joe Biden's brow, you know, in Congress and then in the Senate sometime
we're now in
the
three
second,
different
you know, two
mythologies.
Centuries
and I really appreciate yes. that in your answer.
And they're all at, I would rather live in any of them than in the Stark world that we live in today. But Schumer has already promised that, like, okay, well, we're going to pack the court. You know, we're going to end the filibuster. He and other Democrats have been talking about ending the Electoral College, but that's not breaking norms. You know, that just makes sense. The time has come for that. For me, the biggest problem, and this goes a bit with against what Peter's saying, is that Congress isn't do nothing. All they fucking do is spend money all of the time. And that's why we have, you know, $1 bazillion in debt with no sign of stopping. And we'll get to it. But, you know, the last thing that happened, they're at loggerheads over spending $300 billion in new spending or $3.4 trillion in new spending. That's the argument that Congress is having. That's the norm. You know, not, you know, Congress spending money.
Nick, you
and
will
not
be
doing
happy
anything
to hear
else,
then so. That the reports are that the Supreme Court fight will probably delay Congress from spending a bunch of new money on coronavirus relief. We'll talk about that later. Right. But I actually have a question for Nick, for Catherine, I guess for Matt here. No, for Matt as well. So,
but not for Matt.
So
no,
we
no,
all
not
agree that
never
what McConnell did with Merrick Garland was by the books legal. There was no sort of procedural, or there was no technical legal violation. It would be legal if McConnell could push through and get a vote on a replacement here before the election. It would certainly be legal. No, there would be no violation of laws. As I understand it, the same would be true for court packing. To add justices, do we think that the merits of these things
absolutely.
Are equally the same if they are both within the purview, within the sort of constitutional authority of the people in power to do so?
I mean, I think one thing that like that what that question brings into relief is it's a slightly smarter way of doing the whataboutism or the kind of both sidesism question, because I think it's undeniably true that if the partisan positioning was precisely reversed, that Democrats would clearly be pushing through their nominee right now also. Like, I think that's true. But you don't actually even really have to ask that question. You can just ask the question like, well, will they do the court packing? Will they do these other legal yet semi-outlandish remedies, you know, if they see a Republican come in?
But shouldn't we be thinking about political blowback and potential consequences? I'm not saying that that question should be the only question that guides us. And yet it's a question we should ask and raise. What are the likely consequences of an act that will be correctly or incorrectly perceived as an act of political war?
Let me just finish quick, which is that I actually do think...
In some ways, the strongest case is for the individual action of these specific Republican senators who have already said, who have already kind of reserved the right to vote against. And in particular, if Trump loses the election and the nominee has not yet been approved at that point, I think there's a very strong case that it is incumbent on the individual senators to vote differently. But I think that's a separate question from what are the partisan imperatives and what are the reasonable expectations and what would be legal or kind of morally acceptable to us.
The reason I chuckled, Catherine, is because then we're back to the John F. Kennedy mythology of Profiles of Courage, which is his Pulitzer Prize winning book about senators who voted against their constituents' will and suffered the consequences, right? And it's clear he didn't write it. He may not have even read it. That being said, I think you're right to the after the election, depending on what happens, the focus should shift to the conscience of individual senators and, you know, how they vote. Peter, I think court packing is a bigger threat from a libertarian perspective, because at this point, although maybe not structurally, ultimately, because once you reset the number of justices, it does matter who is on the court. I don't think the court is as important as people tend to say. But when you look at somebody like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she, you know, voted for all of the expansive rights in cases that were related to Obamacare. She voted, she was bad on Kelo, bad on Raich, the medical marijuana law that expanded the Commerce Clause, you know, to ridiculous lengths or certified it. She was terrible on Citizens United, And she was terrible on all of the recent gun cases that came up. You know, from a strict, you know, strictly libertarian point of view, to the extent that somebody is going to be put on the court in the next 6 months, it's probably better that it's somebody on a Federalist Society list than whoever the Democrats come up with, just strictly speaking.
But to the spirit of Peter's inquiry, perhaps, here's a way of thinking about it. Catherine, you breezed over the hypocrisy charge. Nick, you went to the familiar argument that, you know, Trump's just the, you know, the latest in a long line.
That's not a familiar argument, Matt.
It is, because you make it on this
podcast. That's not what you hear from Democrats. That, I mean, if you hear public discourse, Trump's fans and the Democrats.
We hear, though. We are familiar with it.
Both hold him as a uniquely singular, you know, being.
Familiar argument from Nick Gillespie on this podcast to listeners here. But does not that process, especially, I mean, everyone's having too much fun, the Lindsey Graham clip, and I'm guilty of it as well. I just couldn't find the one from Trump that I wanted. But the when you have such kind of blatant hypocrisy, is there not an argument, Nick, that that also adds to something else that you've written a lot about, which is how we are increasingly a low trust society, and
Absolutely.
That everyone sees politics as this instrument, a club of power, and they will absolutely, you know, shape and warp and justify their behavior based on naked power considerations. And the more that people do this openly, it is not like a blessing of transparency. It's actually going to create more of a cycle of this type of behavior, which tends to be, given the size and scope of government, bad when it's exercised, particularly by someone who has police power.
Yeah, I don't think that there's a way out on this, because even if, let's say, Mitch McConnell was, said, you know what, like, you know, under consideration, we should wait to let the next president pick. Would that pick be somebody who is a compromise character or something like that? I don't think in this next, you know, scene, you know, or a vignette of the ongoing decline in trust and confidence in government in particular, there's no way out. This isn't going to happen here. And all I'm saying is that if, you know, if the things that I care about on the margins that the Supreme Court can affect them, and the one thing that is bad is that any Republican nominee, any Trump nominee is going to be insane on abortion. And almost certainly, I mean, Gorsuch actually kind of split the baby, so to speak, on that recently. You know, in the near term and in the long term, I think if it's also it depends on who is nominated and how they do in the nomination hearings, because if it's somebody who comes through and is, you know, credible and reasonable, I think people can say the larger context, this is screwed up. But overall, that's not.
There's also a practical issue of timing, which is that with just 40 or so days left before the election, it's really not clear that that Mitch McConnell will be able to run the entire process and hold a vote before the election.
Maybe not before the election, but certainly before the end of the term. And Mitch is capable of moving fast. You know, he just has to snort enough cocaine, half the cocaine he's selling.
Is this time to, I mean, we've already had Nick's mythology world glimpse. Is this time to confess the dreams that I had last night, Catherine, about Mitch McConnell?
Sure is. Yes, it is.
So Drew, I was in Washington's Union Station, beautiful station, recently renovated train station, and Mitch McConnell was there. And I was like, damn it, Mitch, you just didn't use your power and ability to limit the size and scope of government. That's what I'm mad about. And then Chuck Schumer walked up, and then they had a quick tete-a-tete having to do with the coronavirus relief bill. And then I continued with the harangue, and then my dream moved on. Catherine, do you have any interpretations?
I was just hoping the end of that dream was going to be like fisticuffs or like, I don't know, an orgy or something. Like, frankly, it was just like way tamer than I was hoping for. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like the character here is Lindsey Graham.
Well, it was in a train station.
Oh, yeah, because there's definitely never been, you know, inappropriate behavior at Union Station. I've never seen that.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's you know, the whole subtext is it's a sex dream.
It's always a sex dream, Nick.
Every dream.
you know, the Lindsey Graham character in this is, you know, we've made a lot of jokes in 2020 here about how the screenwriters are getting lazier and lazier. But like the perfection of those Lindsey Graham clips is really something else. And I think we should play here me in a January Before Times podcast in which I say the words, you die a hero or you live long enough to see yourself become Lindsey Graham. And if that's not me seeing straight to this dark future, I don't know what is.
Wow. Just pointing at the scoreboard.
What? But was Lindsey Graham, was younger Lindsey Graham a hero or
like, was there a point when he could have died a hero? Himself? Is that your question? Yeah.
No. The answer is firmly no.
I'm just asking. I mean, he seems to have come. He's a character who hasn't shown a lot of growth.
He arrived as a full-fledged anti-hero at best.
Suderman, you are Captain Norms on this squad. What say you to the pretty widespread reaction, at least among the kind of media and Democratic Twitter class? Jeffrey Toobin, the air quote legal analyst of The New Yorker, has a piece on this, and his tweet like distills it pretty greatly. It is, Dems aren't powerless. They can won. Abolish filibuster. 2, statehood for DC. Sure. And PR, Puerto Rico. 3, increase number of federal judges. And 4, add 3 justices to SCOTUS. He left off, 5, President Bobcat. But what the hell, Peter? I thought Joe Biden was our norms restorer. And I got a bunch of Democrats out here wanting to burn the whole
The first thing Joe Biden's going to do when he becomes president is to hold a screening of Dirty Work, the great Norm Macdonald film from the 1990s. No. And it's going to be about bringing back our norms, the ones that matter. Norm Macdonald is the only Norm that matters, I think.
But he's Canadian. We can't use him as an American Norm. Yeah, Supreme Court.
Every
Norm
night we're going to get a radio broadcast in which Norm Macdonald tells the moth joke, and it's going to bring America together. And I'm really serious because it's the best joke of all time. Here's the thing. Everyone talks a big game about norms, and very few people in politics are actually committed to preserving them when it counts, which is when it counts against you and your team. And I think Mitch McConnell has been most out front about this over the last couple of years, but that's partially because he has been the person in power and who is in a position to be out front in terms of norm breaking. And that if Democrats had control of the Senate, look at what Harry Reid did with the filibuster. That is where a lot of this started. Now, it is also true that Mitch McConnell took what Harry Reid did and ran with it and expanded on it.
Can you remind listeners Harry Reid did with the filibuster and why?
He got rid of the filibuster for non-Supreme Court judges, I believe, or for...
And all nominations that had to be confirmed by the Senate.
And Mitch McConnell said to Harry Reid when he was about to do this, if you do, we will take this and we will use it to our advantage. The thing is about Mitch McConnell is like... that always bugs me is that he's not someone with obvious policy goals. The closest thing you can say to him, say about him having clear policy, sort of ideological policy goals, is that he does appear to like to prefer judges that are more in line with the sort of Federalist Society model of judicial understanding. And that there is something, I think, good just from a kind of libertarian policy outlook from to that. But Mitch McConnell's real goal in every single thing he does is simply to preserve Republican seats, Republican power, and thus his own power in the Senate. And there's not like a second order goal of something they want to do with that power. It's just we want Republican power for its own sake so that we have it and the other guys don't. It's football. It's just sort of points in service of nothing. And Mitch McConnell is always trying to put points on the board in service of no larger ideology or sort of vision of America. This was his reputation even before he was a majority leader. Back when he was the whip, he was known as an extremely effective tactician. You would give him a mission say, here's your goal. And then he would make it happen with the caucus. And he was very good at that. But he wasn't somebody who you would go to say, what should our goal be? What should our policy, so what is our vision for government and how should we enact that? Instead, he was the guy who you gave the mission and said, here, go do that. And the court thing, even the court thing, as much as, you know, I, in fact, appreciate the Federalist Society vision of, judicial thinking and philosophy, and as much as I think that it is valuable, a lot of the reason that Mitch McConnell has prioritized moving judges through the system is, one, because Republican voters like it and it brings them out and they just prefer it, but two, because Mitch McConnell wants to relieve his senators of responsibility for hard decisions as much as possible, and that is done by offloading a lot of the responsibilities of the legislative branch to the courts.
If I may, Peter, I would take issue with some of what you're saying in that Mitch McConnell may not have an explicit ideological framework that comports with, you know, a kind of Reagan-esque rhetoric about small government, et cetera. Under Mitch McConnell's watch, when the War Crimes Tribunal come against how badly governed we have been in just the 21st century, let's leave the 20th century to the, you know, burnt out ends of, you know, memories and things like that.
Bygones be bygones.
Mitch McConnell has overseen a massive expansion in the size, scope, and spending of government in all sorts of ways, and he should be held accountable. He is a terrible majority leader for the country. Maybe he's been okay for the Republicans, although, you know, there's been, you know, hiccups along the way, but he is a disaster, every bit as much as all of the House speakers in the 21st century. I mean, in a weird way, like the least damaging House speaker was the one who was an actual child molester, if only because he was in power for, you know, the shortest period of time. But Mitch McConnell is bad news. And there is an ideology behind what he has overseen. And it is a massive, massive expansion of government at the cost of individual liberty.
I think I slightly disagree with that, and just in the sense that the expansion of government has come, it's like the Mitch McConnell policy agenda is a lot more spending on everything and somewhat lower taxes on corporations and individuals. And so you have that's like the recipe for just getting Republicans more elected, right? Like, and that's, it's not a vision of government per se.
Who cares about Republicans? What I'm saying is, from a libertarian perspective, he's a disaster, and there is a consciousness there that we can govern. I believe in the death of the author. I don't care about his intentions, but the text that he is writing is god awful from a libertarian point of view. And that's my point. And he should be held accountable for that, as should all of the other, you know, sad sacks of hooey that are in the House and the Senate.
Catherine, I just want to point out at the halfway point of this podcast that Peter has attempted two sports ball metaphors, and Nick is the only one with an Avengers reference going on here. So,
wow. I mean, strictly speaking, I think that was a Norse mythology reference, but.
I think even the Scandinavians now admit that they, you know, they're.
Marvel is canon for their
that's right.
Entire.
They read Stanley's soapbox as
tradition
the
and
Talbot
faith.
Of,
sure.
Of the sagas.
I mean.
Yeah. You yeah. just thought you mean. Let's shift. Suderman teased it earlier. I was blissfully unaware of American politics last week. What's the status of the 4.0 coronavirus relief package? Has this indeed scotched for the pre-election session of Congress?
So about a week and a half ago, I should say, I was also blissfully unaware of American politics for the last week, but I'll tell you about this anyway.
You guys are being redundant. You can just say I was unaware of American politics.
I was. Was blissful. I looked at sunsets and I drank scotch and it was wonderful. So about a week and a half ago, Democrats blocked a small ball coronavirus relief bill. And just to give you a sense of what small is in this,
as opposed to hardball,
right, what a diminutive
responsible ball.
So Democrats were asking for Batman and Republicans offered up Robin.
God damn it.
You really should have gone with like a Whitey Herzog reference
here.
The word
emaciated was actually used to describe $300 billion.
It was a $650 billion bill that repurposed about $350 billion that had already been authorized and added about $300 billion in new spending. And Democrats rejected that as way, way, way too little. And Nancy Pelosi actually got mad when people accused her of scotching this bill. She told her members, we don't want to go home without a bill, but don't be a cheap date. As if the $650 billion is a cheap date. So now there is at least a little bit more sort of discussion about, well, we still need a coronavirus relief bill is the thinking amongst a bunch of people here in Washington, including the White House, which is saying that they will support a relief bill that spends up to $1.5 trillion. So that's the White House position currently, is that they would like to spend up to $1.5 trillion. And Democrats are saying, no, that's still too little. Our preferred bill is about $3.3, $3.4 trillion. That's the HEROES Act that they proposed a couple of months ago and have been stumping for since. But they are willing to negotiate down to $2.2 trillion. That's their sort of lower bound. So right now, the divide is between the White House position of saying we want $1.5 trillion, and I'm certain that Mitch McConnell would give it to them if he thought he had the votes for it. Currently, he does not. And the Pelosi Democrat position of at least 2.2, but really, we need to be doing $3 point something trillion. And then hanging over all of this is a separate negotiation about keeping funding for the government, which will shut down without another short-term spending bill before September 30th. They almost passed a bill at the end of last week, but it got hung up in disputes over farm aid. Because there's like a 20...
Bet they wish they had gotten that done now.
Yeah, there's like a $20 billion slush fund built into this bill. And because Trump said on the campaign trail last week something about, hey, we're going to support you farmers, all the ones he screwed with his trade war. Hey, we're going to support you farmers. Democrats are now concerned that that $20 billion or so basically just becomes political play money for Trump to buy votes from, people that he wants votes from in Pennsylvania and other places.
I'm
really kind of annoyed. Nobody's buying my vote, you know, and I would be one of the few people explicitly willing to sell it. So, you know.
I feel like I do have like a certain amount of sympathy for Congress, because I feel like I have absolutely done this thing where I'm like, all right, I have a difficult but like fundamentally knowable and doable task. And I didn't quite get it done, you know, on like a Friday afternoon. But it's OK. I can finish it on Monday morning. And then on Monday morning, like an apocalyptic new kind of task appears. And you're like, oh, man, past me. Knew better than to not finish the basic doable task, because it's 2020. And there's always an apocalyptic unknown task right over the horizon. And then here we are.
I feel like we're about to slip into either talking about Tenet, the Christopher Nolan movie about temporal pincers, or Avengers Endgame. Catherine, all you need to do is go back to the previous timeline.
I wasn't
going to
talk about either of those things, because unlike some people on this podcast, I don't suffer from monomania.
Although we could talk about the snap and then snap funding. Yeah. Think about it.
Matthew.
Oh, that would be it. Because, thank you, Matt. Thanos is going to wipe out world hunger.
It's worth pointing like out that. Because people don't.
You snapped twice, so I think we might have actually just lost.
Well, yeah, no. And Thanos, of course, gets rid of world hunger by getting rid of hunger.
By getting
right. Yeah, by killing everyone. Yeah,
thank you for just underlining that.
One of the reverse benefits. What's the opposite of benefits? Demerits?
Cost.
No, but
I mean, I don't know where you're going with this, but like,
when you don't have, when you no longer have a major political party in this country that cares,
Matt, that's freedom. Freedom is the word for nothing left to lose.
That doesn't care about stuff like, really bad trade policies, or you know, debts and deficits.
Or anything.
Except for Arby's. When you have that, then people don't make a ruckus about stuff that they would have gone crazy over before, If you recall, one just a random point of comparison that I think Eric Boehm has made, if that's how you pronounce his name, at Reason in the past, is that Republicans used to go ballistic about Solyndra, right? The amount of subsidies that went into a lousy solar manufacturer here.
And robots that sang Disney songs.
Well, I mean, that's pretty cool. I thought that's Zendaya, right? Just kidding.
No, that's what was working. What was at Solyndra. They had robots that moved around the shop floor singing Disney songs.
I think Kurt Russell was in that picture. No, but also, people used to, Republicans used to talk a lot about how bad it was that the Obama-Biden bailout of GM and all this kind of stuff cost the country 10, you know, 12, $15 billion. I forget what the final price tag on that transaction ended up being. We spend more than that every year compensating farmers just for the net bad effects of the trade war with China.
Matt, American farmers are the coccyx of America. You know, I mean, they are a useless appendage that we have evolved past, but we must support them lest we fail as a nation.
I mean, this is the other thing that I didn't mention is that because Congress has not gotten together to pass a giant spending bill, another one, the Trump administration is saying that they are considering unilaterally doing a bunch of this stuff on their own, including setting up a support system for the airline industry.
Oh, good.
The next big White House lawn rally is going to be Trump doing random feats of strength, I think, like blowing up water bottles and bending metal bars into hearts or something. You know, he can do it all. He can do it all, really.
Will he bend the spoon, Nick?
It is not the spoon that bends. We'll bend the spoon downward. It is you.
I thought there was no spoon.
Exactly, Catherine. Yeah. Let's continue in our torturous tour of
in torturous
Washington
duty.
Weirdness, torturous transitions. The president said on Saturday that he had just approved his forced sale, or as I like to say, forced sale of the video sharing app TikTok. Although, as a parent of a tween, I think we can all agree that TikTok should be banned for at least until they grow up. For sale of TikTok from the Red Chinese to some new American conglomerate involving Walmart, Oracle, you know, ByteDance, whatever the hell that is. And as part of this heavy-handed intervention into markets, which is the kind of thing that Republicans used to care about, the president announced, and I'm sorry to laugh because
TikTok
really
is going to be housed in the abandoned Carrier air conditioning factory in Indiana.
Just be a bunch of people standing in front of like old air conditioners doing little viral dances,
watching cuties on their phone.
What's the name of the Wisconsin of
Foxconn? Oh, put them in the Foxconn factory.
Foxconn will finally. Yeah. It'll be American Foxconn. And they'll just be doing TikTok dance videos with my daughters. Anyways, as part of this exciting new venture that the federal government has forced into being, probably all at the behest of Peter Thiel, if we're being honest about that, the participants, according to Trump, although I think they have a different story, agreed to voluntarily contribute $5 billion to a patriotic education fund that might just be called the 1776 Project to own the libs at the New York Times. Catherine, do you want to soliloquize about how this is everything that you love in
this
government behavior?
This is some garbage. I mean, honestly, like, there's so many things about this. I do want to highlight one small detail, which is I think in the Bloomberg report about the latest iteration of this deal, there's a sentence that just says, ByteDance first heard about the $5 billion education fund from news reports, a company spokeswoman said. So this is, you know, just to be clear, this is Donald Trump saying, first of all, from the White House, I am engineering the precise nature of the ownership structure of a tech company. And also, we're going to extract $5 billion from your hypothetical future IPO or wherever that money is coming from. And we're going to use it to dictate slash, I mean, I guess it's not that because it's a Donald Trump plan, we don't have any actual details, but...
Donald Trump also does not have any actual details?
Correct. No one has any details because they don't exist. But that somehow it is going to American school, all American school children will now learn a particular narrative about the American founding. And I don't know if y'all remember when we were talking right before the RNC about how there was no Republican platform, but there was this Trump agenda, this like many points of a Trump agenda, and the two education points, one of them was teach American exceptionalism. And I threw a little hissy fit because A, American exceptionalism means something else, not the thing that Donald Trump meant, and B, because it would not be good for the federal government to dictate curriculum at the in local schools.
Yeah, that's what we have the New York Times for.
This has exceeded my fears so spectacularly that we would extract $5 billion of funding to do this unconstitutional thing from.
But it's not happening. From what the news reports I've read were that it's not happening.
But just the whole theory of it, the whole house of cards of it, you know, that it's coming from a Republican administration, we should already be reconciled to. But that it would just hit an incredible bingo card of things libertarians both hate and fear. I'm triggered, is what I'm saying, Matt.
This is not the first time that something like this has happened. Wow. You guys remember in, I think it was April, Trump did a press conference with a whole bunch of tech companies that were going to be working on the coronavirus and like putting up data dashboards and websites with information.
Yeah. And he
about
like told Google that Google had already started a project to solve coronavirus.
And Google was like, huh, that's interesting. I guess we'll have to start building a website to solve coronavirus. Because they definitely hadn't and were not aware of it until they heard it at the press conference.
Confirming or bolstering my theory that Donald Trump, his real domestic political opponent, or at least mirror, is Bill de Blasio. The same thing happened in New York with like all of the schools and the teachers were in the middle of having 75 different like conference calls with parents about how the school year is going to start like Monday, meaning this Monday. And then in the middle of those calls is when de Blasio announced, oh yeah, we're going to delay it again until September 29th and maybe later there. So that was the first that any of them heard about it too. It's great to have.
This is the dark
leaders.
Side of New York politics becoming the center of attention in America again. I mean, between Trump, AOC, de Blasio, Hillary Clinton, you know,
Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, no, as much as it kind of as somebody born in Brooklyn and who moved back to New York after 30 years in internal exile, you know, I'm kind of into it, but it really is the worst set of, you know, whatever H.P. Lovecraft, whatever dark buried secret under Red Hook he talked about in the story Terror at Red Hook, it's bubbling up into American politics.
I do feel like Alexander Hamilton is also somehow to blame for all this. Like,
yeah,
he gets some for sure.
The only good one who comes out, I mean, in all of this, it's really just Aaron Burr is the only one who comes out looking good.
Yeah. I want to, if Catherine's going to be taking credit for her bone motts from months past, I wrote a column that was given some of a pushback at the time in 2016 saying that Ted Cruz was right. I don't know. This is, 17 lifetimes ago. Ted Cruz is right to condemn New York values, although for the wrong reasons, because I think he was trying to talk about the homosexuals or something. But like, we
Alberta
had to.
Ted doesn't understand America. I mean, he's a Canadian. What does he know?
He's going to be our next.
He's like Justin Trudeau. He's the Justin Trudeau.
He
of the
wishes.
Senate.
He'll be the next Supreme Court justice after we confirm. Whoever that nice Hispanic Florida woman is.
I do like the court packing thing. Like, I mean, that might be my only chance of getting on the Supreme Court when everybody is on it. And then we just have like,
that's how we're going to get to,
are we somehow,
I
guess
that's how we're going to get really to a national popular vote, right? Yeah. Is if every single adult,
everyone
is
appointed to the Supreme Court
and then every issue,
but then we really got to fix
like
the post office.
It'll be like those churches where everyone is an elder or a pastor or whatever. Like it's, I think we can do it, guys.
Yeah.
Nick, has there been a Rutgers Supreme Court justice?
RBG was the first job she had, and she was tenured was at Rutgers Law
School. I cannot believe you were able to answer that question.
It was one of the few places. She's right up there with, there's a whole series of Rutgers women in high office, including Hazel O'Leary, who was kicked out of being the Secretary of Energy for spending more on travel than she did on, like, actually running the energy system in America. And, of course, Sister Solja was she's a minister in waiting, but Sister Solja, also a big Rutgers.
Where did MC
Matt,
Lights
how come you didn't ask go? Me if there were any Supreme Court justices from my college?
No, well, it's if there are any who are not from you, who have not been polluted.
I mean, were they all on the rowing team like you, or just
not on the rowing
they
team.
All bought their way? Like, Lori Loughlin paid for their
sailing.
Education.
You're on the sailing team. You're on the team that doesn't actually work.
The real question is, who is the New Jersey Scalia, since he was suffocated by ironically, and people don't talk about this, but it was a MyPillow that was on top of his face.
That's absolutely true.
That's that's I don't want to start conspiracies, but it was it was the interlocking. filling, that
Nick,
he couldn't
that,
get out.
That, by the way,
of,
is a perfect example of, like, here's how you test a conspiracy theory, and you say the conspiracy theory, and then you try two different soundtracks, and the first soundtrack is the X-Files opening music, and the other is the Benny Hill theme. And it's like, those are your two choices, and like, the only true ones are the ones that work with the Benny Hill theme.
Wait, no. The only true ones are the ones that work with both.
Ooh.
Oh, is that, and that's your, theory? Okay.
In any case.
Okay.
I miss when New Jersey was the problem with the Supreme Court. Anybody who had like some history, and actually many of them still do, but there was that moment where I guess it was Scalia and Alito were both from Trenton, New Jersey, of all places.
Oh, God. Trenton makes the world
takes. So it's like them and Bo Bielinski. That's the holy trinity of post-apocalyptic America, America.
I feel like we've all been this entire podcast in the what are you consuming segments, mostly on the psychedelics, psilocybins and such. Yeah, but why don't
there
we go
are
ahead?
Not, the antipsychotic drug has not been invented that we could consume as a country that would bring us back to something approaching normal.
Nick, what have you been consuming culturally, at the very least?
So I was reading, and I recommended very much so, Oliver Stone's memoir, which came out a couple of months ago, maybe. But it's really good, and I'm going to tell you the exact title as soon as I can find it again. It's Chasing the Light: How I Fought My Way into Hollywood from the 1960s to Platoon. And it as the title gives it away, it starts with him in the late 60s actually attending NYU film school on the GI Bill. And then it ends with his massive multi-award winning night at the Oscars when Platoon won a fistful of awards. And it's really fascinating. It's like one of the ultimate boomer, OK Boomer texts. But Oliver Stone, who was born in 1946, raised in New York of a family, he had a French mother and an American father who was Jewish and also who worked but kind of hid it and was on Eisenhower's staff in Europe during World War II. Stone starts off going to boarding school. He ends up in Vietnam in the shit, works as a merchant marine after dropping out of Yale, then goes to NYU film school. And he had an incredible run in the mid, starting in the very late 70s through the early mid 90s, which was the moment when the boomer kind of culture came on full line, where they really occupied a place of pride in America. And it's a really fascinating book. He's a serious guy who I know a lot of people who are libertarian hate, because he's very much into a kind of conspiracist, mostly left-wing vision of American history. But, movies like Platoon, movies like JFK, certainly, Wall Street, which is inane from an actual finance point of view, is a fantastic zeitgeist film. And he also, weirdly enough, and this is for the Ayn Rand fans out there, he was desperate to remake The Fountainhead. And he's... ultimately, he's an individualist of the left. And I think one thing that would help America move forward is to focus once again on individualism rather than on kind of tribalism or group identity and communal identity, regardless whether it's on the right or left or libertarian or progressive, whatever. So I highly recommend Oliver Stone's Chasing the Light.
Nice.
I definitely thought you were going to say what would help America move forward is a new adaptation of The Fountainhead.
Yeah, no. Architecture is over. We're on to city planners now. I think Seinfeld put a pin in the dream of being an architect. You should be a city planner.
He is mostly known as a director, but he is also a great screenwriter. He wrote the screenplay for Brian De Palma's Scarface and the screenplay for the John Milius Conan the Barbarian.
He talks about the Conan stuff, and obviously you can imagine him and John Milius did not get along, and he says that the Conan script that he wrote was completely taken away.
Didn't he also write Salvador?
He wrote and directed that, which is a fantastic movie. Yeah. I think from a libertarian point of view, it's often seen as a kind of left-wing thing. Scarface is another one of those movies that it still defines, like, to a certain level, hip-hop culture, but, as a kind of in dialogue with the gangster film of the same name from the 1930s through The Godfather to, you know, the setting things in Miami among Cuban gangsters. Fantastic. I mean, if you want to understand, you know, kind of late 20th century culture, you really should know Oliver Stone and take seriously his obsessions and the responses to them, which were extremely heated and nasty and, you know, and well, oftentimes well articulated, but just a really fascinating character. And it's a great tour through a Hollywood system that doesn't really exist anymore either.
He is one of the directors who takes most seriously the push and pull between private culture and political culture. And all of his sort of seminal films from the 80s and early 90s are about that in some sense, about the ways that politics changes the, you know, sort of American cultural life, and then American cultural life in turn changes politics.
Right.
No, I think we can all agree that JFK, which is arguably his best film, is a documentary. What did you consume?
Yeah. I just want to point out that his best film is The Doors. But continue.
I'll tell you someday about my dream about that. Catherine,
it was also a sex dream. I consumed.
All dreams are sex dreams, except for sex dreams, which are about trans.
Yeah, which are about mortality, I think. So I consumed Burn In, which is a recommendation from Reason's own Ron Bailey, who is always to be trusted on science fiction recommendations. It is a novel by P.W. Singer and August Cole. And it is it actually starts, fittingly enough for this podcast, in Union Station. There's a huge set piece in a very near future Union Station that starts with a traffic jam on Louisiana Avenue in the circle leading up to Union Station.
Which is because of frickin' city planners absolutely botching that restoration like 5-6 years ago. It's unbelievably terrible. Go on.
Was it the restoration like 20 years ago?
Matt's, you know what, time...
No,
time,
no, the,
time is a flat circle. Time is a flat traffic circle. And we are in a traffic jam in it. So the book is sort of a techno thriller. Without giving away too much, there are some real Caves of Steel vibes for those of you who read and enjoyed Isaac Asimov's human robot buddy cop comedy mystery. that's kind of what's going on in here. I am not done with it yet, but I have to say it is excellent. I recommend it for those who want to lean into the techno-futurist darkness, but not too far. And it has footnotes, which is cool. So you can, as you're reading along, kind of understand which technologies in the book are already in existence, but not widespread, still theoretical, etc., which I always like a good footnote.
Have you ever recommended something, Catherine, before finishing it, and then when you finish it, you were like, oh boy, I really wish I hadn't?
Once on this podcast, you may recall that I once retracted a recommendation for another podcast because I listened to a few more episodes and I was like, yeah, it's actually not great. So it happens occasionally, but Ron Bailey has finished this book and says it's good all the way through, which is enough for me.
Peter, what have you been consuming?
I read the novel A Memory Called Empire by it is the debut novel by Arkady Martin, the pen name of Anna Linden Weller, who is a city planner and also a PhD historian.
It's all coming together, guys.
And it's so this book won this year's Hugo Award for Best Novel. It came out just a little over a year ago.
Hugo.
It's a big, crazy sort of political space opera murder mystery that has both very strong Ian M. Banks culture vibes and very strong Isaac Asimov Foundation vibes, with a little more sort of contemporary politics. Not contemporary. Imperial
Matt is melting as you
described
the various
slides. It's really well done. It's really smart. It's interesting about cities and politics and about culture clashes and the conflicts they produce. Strongly recommend it for anybody who likes great classic space opera.
Is it what is the city planning divide? Is it between the Jane Jacobses of the future and the Robert Moseses, or
so the
does
book
it break
mainly
down?
Takes place. The book mainly takes place on the planet that is the capital of this of the main empire in the book, and of course the planet is a city planet, as we have seen in Star Wars. That Asimov has Trantor, you know, in his Foundation books, and it is entirely governed by an AI that was created by like their science minister, I believe, or maybe their information. I think it's their science minister. And so there's all sorts of interesting complications that come from the fact that the AI is not totally neutral. It has it effectively has values that are built into it because it was programmed by an individual. And so then when there is an imperial succession conflict, the AI's programming and values come into play there. And it's a book about politics and city planning, and also like,
are they anti-chain store?
That's some good Fukuyama right there. That was, y'all may recall, like less ballyhooed Fukuyama prediction was that, you know, he who builds the AI / clones will embed them with his values, and so we need to watch out for them.
We could keep talking about this like until the end of history. But we probably need to reach.
I sat here and listened to you guys talk about freaking Oliver Stone or whatever for like half an hour.
We probably need to reach the end of the podcast first.
Do we?
So my cultural recommendation is a cheat because I like to do that.
Is it Major League Baseball, Matt Welch?
Close to it. I was in Southern California last week, and
live in Prague? What you were just visiting Southern California?
Thank you for bringing that up. And I do what I always do in Southern California, which is drive around and you listen to the radio, because California has pretty good radio culture, Southern California. And I happened to be listening to a lot of sports radio, and what I'm recommending, not necessarily because of its artistic content, but for what it tells us about the state of California, where Nick is ensconcing himself in right now,
In velvet.
Is that, my God, the commercials on sports radio right now in Southern California are dark, people. Like before, it's just like beer, trucks, you know, Jack in the Box food.
Can
and
you
now
combine
it's
those
like,
things?
Are you contemplating suicide? Mike Trout and his wife are begging you to not jump off the bridge. Here's the hotline.
Oh, no.
There were like, you know, sleep gummies. Everything was so desperate. And in fact, it really reflected there's an apocalyptic desperation to California right now, which is just really grim. I mean, there's the fires and the orange sky, which is a little bit lessened now. Air quality is bad, but also they've been kind of locked down more than most of the rest of the country for 6 months. And my ongoing theory is that the maximum hamster act for humans is about 3 months, and after that you just get weird. I was like meeting with my old high school friends, and they just all had 1,000-yard stares. And just, you know, we sat in a huge socially distant semicircle, and we're talking about, you know, my name is Matt, and I'm a rageaholic. It's a weird, grim, dark dystopia out there. But shining light, very quick anecdote among that. I come from a place that is a baseball fanatic from, you know, 3-year-olds up in the way out. And I was with an old friend who's become a big muckety muck little league manager, which matters in that part of the world. And I'm like, dude, what are you doing? You're like, it's the lockdowns. How are you reacting? Here's how he reacted. He's created Prohibition Little League Baseball. He's found a secret field.
They're playing underground baseball.
I can only reveal so much, but there are code words. There are code words.
Like, I love
this. They see the
so
white
much.
Vans coming. They yell a certain thing, and then the kids all know what to do. The opposing managers are never to know his name for plausible deniability. It is the single greatest story I've ever heard, and it makes me very, very proud to be an alumnus of Long Beach, the greatest city on the planet. Okay, that's all the alumnusizing we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable. This was a fun episode. I think we all agree. And next week it'll be even funner because we're even closer to the election. And that's always super, super duper fun. Okay, keep listening to all Reason podcasts at reason.com/podcast, especially, though not only, the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, which usually happens on Wednesdays. Okay, goodbye.